Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Today I am going to be reviewing the book by Joe Haldeman called Forever Peace. And I'm reading this because it's one of the few books, one of the 20 so books, that won both the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award for the same book in the same year. And So the reason I'm doing that is, of course, I'm trying to get through all of the books which won both of the awards at some point in the history of the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. There's quite a few which I've already read going back a long way, but yeah, I thought I'd top it off and read and review the last seven or eight which I hadn't got to already. And it's been a fun project, and this time it's been an interesting thing because, you know, The Forever War, which is the first book in this series, is well worth its position, a well-earned position as a classic of science fiction, a really great exploration of what it's like to be a soldier, you know, enlisted or conscripted into a war, and what happens when you come back after the war, and if you go away to another and keeps coming back, you know, it's obviously called The Forever War for a reason. And I thought it was quite a very good book. Now, there is another book that I read and reviewed for the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast, also by Joe Haldeman, called The Accidental Time Machine, and that was really good. Really good, fun time travel story. Up until the first third of the way through the book, I reviewed this back episode 51. Did I say that already? Anyway, I gave it 2.5 stars, and the reason's that because it doesn't matter how good the first third of the book was, the second third and the last third were absolutely terrible. And I said, hey, everyone, just read the first third of the book, and it makes for a good, fun science fiction time travel novella. Don't keep reading on. And I'm thinking, okay, going into Forever Peace, is it going to be the same quality as Forever War? Is it going to be just really, really good? Or is it going to be like The Accidental Time Machine, a bit uneven, and it starts off good and goes downhill? Because I've heard that's what some of Joe Haldeman's books read like. And I must admit, it's very much like the second one. The first half of this book is really, really good. I really, really enjoyed it. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. The second half of this book, it took such a downturn, it became one of the worst reading experiences I've had in a long time. And if you look back at some of the ratings that I've given books recently, that's saying quite something. And I think it was such a big, it went down so much just because I was so much enjoying the first half. And I was thinking, this is going to be really good. This is going to be one of the best books I've read this year so far. No problem at all. And it took such a dive, it was such a big disappointment. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about this book in two halves. First of all, I'm going to review the first half and say everyone should read up, and then I'll say the point everyone should read up into. And then I want to discuss the second half and how it represents everything that I hate about bad science fiction. So starting off in this book, it's set in a world, it's not actually, I don't think, in the same world. Logically, it can't be in the same world as the Forever War. So while it's a thematic follow-up, it doesn't have the same characters, it doesn't have the same technology, it doesn't have the same structure, anything like that at all. It's set some point in the 21st century. It's it was written in 1997, and it's talking about things. Oh, this happened in 2004, and this happened there. And there's people who were alive back in the 20th century who are still alive there in the 21st century. So I guess it's sort of mid to late 21st century. And there is kind of a world war going on, it's not like a world war is in the Second World War. It's more like what we have now is the War on Terror, which I think is actually quite interesting how prescient this book is in many ways. Because, certainly in the second half of the book, which I don't want to get into, it talks about, we're at war at the moment. It's like, well, of course we're at war. We're always at war. We're never not at war. If we're always on the war footing, and if the government always has powers, like war powers, it doesn't go back to peacetime powers. It's always in wartime powers. What kind of things you can get away with, and what civil liberties you can get rid of. Anyway, but the war is kind of a war between the haves and the have-nots. It's based on economic policies. Because the haves have this technological warm fusion, and they've got this replicated technology, so they can use their free energy and put any kind of any materials that they need that they don't want, they can put into these replicators. It's not any waste material, but they any elements that they want to use, any kind of different metals or carbon or anything like that, they can just put it in and it spits out, these replicators spit out anything they want. Even they can spit out new replicators. However, the developed world is saying, hey, we've got this technology, but nobody else can have it because it's so dangerous. If you try and make something and it goes wrong, you can blow up like a massive, you can blow up massive crater in it, and you can destroy whole cities. And so they're saying, we'll keep control of this technology, and if you want something for us, just ask. You know, there's like these special favored nations of the United States, and the special favored nations can maybe get use of a replicator full time, and they can send stuff over, you know, send, you know, fabricated goods, built goods over in one direction, and you know, they can keep it now. Anyway, of course, there's lots of people say, hey, we want something better than this, we want a better life as well. Everyone in America doesn't have to work if they don't want to. They can live in luxury. Everyone gets made clothes for them, food is made for them, nothing really, they don't need to do anything, they don't have to work, they don't have to, you know, it's kind of like a you know, everyone gets like a minimum income, everyone gets different credits that they can use for entertainment, or credits that they can use for food, or going out and doing this and that, or use for taxi rides or travel. So it's this weird kind of like socialist utopia, but at the same time kind of like a dystopian military command structure going on, where people are being conscripted into the army to fight against the have-nots. And the way that the have-nots started the war is that they set off a nuclear bomb in a city in America. I think it was Atlanta. And of course, the United States had to respond in some way. And who were they fighting? Well, it's this kind of nebulous group of, what was it called? Let me look it up here on the Goodreads page. It says, I think at the top here, it says, the Nagumi Wars rages. You know, oh, here it says here, 2043 AD. So yeah, middle of the 21st century. And so the Nagumi are like a collection of rogue states and leaders, like revolutionary leaders within other states, and, you know, and other just warlords and other things like that. And there's always like loads and loads of factions, and they're all kind of getting together and trying to fight against the United States and trying to keep control of their people to then, you know, strike at the heart of the United States. So that's the kind of economic and political setup there. Which is interesting. You know, you could draw parallels to, like, oh, well, it's like the war on terror. You know, there's parallels that you could make to this, even though this was written before that. It was written in 96, 97, or published in 97. So that is one thing that you think, oh, a terrorist attack, that then the United States respond and go in and put army bases in other countries. And money goes in one way and oil goes in the other way, you know, it's all economics based. However, another thing that happens, which I think is quite interesting, is that the war is fought not really by soldiers on the ground, or that happens a little bit, but the United States has drones, which aren't really drones as we think of them now, even though they do have the, what do they call them? The main soldiers that we follow are called the Soldier Boys. And the Soldier Boys are like these robots, which teleoperated war robots, which have got lots of, you know, power and fuel and ammunition and lots of different kinds of weapons, and they'll go in and fight, and you can drop them from planes and they can land and run around and do their stuff, and they're almost indestructible. Not quite indestructible, because we see quite a few of them being destroyed, but they are teleoperated by people hundreds or thousands of kilometers away. But then you've got those are the Soldier Boys, but then you've got the Air Force Boys or the Plane Boys, and then the Navy Boys, which are the boat robots. So you get helicopter robots and soldier robots and plane robots, these drones, which are controlled from a long distance, a little bit like we have today. And even though you have today, like, oh, well, how do you decide what you're going to do? Like, how do you decide who you're going to kill? And what's it like for someone who is actually looking through the eyes of one of these robots and controlling it to kill people, human people, like the enemies on the ground? So that's what a lot of this book is about. A lot of the things that we're hearing about now, it's like, oh, yeah, the drone pilots who have to kill people, who are ordered to kill people, they are getting just as much post-traumatic stress disorder as the soldiers on the ground, or, you know, a similar level. There's no difference between the different levels, and people on the ground are thinking, oh, well, those guys, the teleoperational guys, they're just back in their bunker, back in the United States, or a place in Panama, in the case of this, when the soldiers, a lot of the action happens in Costa Rica, but the soldiers are based in the Panama Canal Zone, I think, is where a lot of the action takes place. But where they're teleoperating the Soldier Boys from. And yeah, so I thought that was actually really quite an interesting exploration of what it's like to be a soldier who is controlling, who isn't there, but is controlling and killing people who are there, which I thought was quite interesting. However, there's another layer on top of this, is that because these soldiers who operate the soldier boys, it's quite a valuable place, it's quite a valuable job, so they don't just want to get anyone to do and volunteer for that. So they conscript people who already have some kind of technical degree or science degree or some kind of degree, so they've already gone through higher education, and then they're conscripted. However, they're not conscripted and then that's their entire life. What happens is that 10 days a month they are controlling the soldier boys, and then for 15-20 days a month they go back to their normal lives and just live their normal lives. And they keep their normal job and they come back for it. People cover them for the 10 days they're away. And then they go and they become like soldier heroes. And then they go back and then they're living their normal life again. And because they're teleoperated and the war is so close to America, it's not like, oh, now we've got to fly everyone all the way out to, say, the Middle East. And they have to be there months and months and ends. And then they can go home and see their family. So it's like this middle ground between like really like strange conscription, like because... like the people who are being conscripted are like these kind of like higher levels of society. You know, they're not just going, oh, let's just get all the, you know, the poor people to fight for us. Let's get the most intelligent people to fight for us. But also they can go back and live their lives. So I understand that Joe Haldeman was saying, hey, when I went to Vietnam, I was taken away from everything I knew. And then when I came back, everything was different. And that's what the Forever War is about. It's about someone who goes away and comes back. And every time he comes back, hundreds of years has gone past and it feels like the world has progressed, you know, more and more and more. You know, I think it, first of all, just a few years have gone past, and the next section of the book, you know, dozens of years have gone past, and then hundreds of years have passed, and then 1,000 years have passed. Here, it's like, go away for 10 days and you're back and you've got to live in your own body again. You're not doing this teleoperating presence, whatever. Goes away, comes back, it's another 10 days. How is he changed? How has the world changed in that 10 days? How is the relationship with the other characters that he works with in his university and his students and things like that? And how does all that go? And then he goes away and comes back in 10 days later. So you've got this similar cycle in the Forever War. That's why I think this is, at least this first half of this book, is an interesting follow-up to that. It's like, how do we get around the problem of soldiers coming back after war and they've changed so much, nobody recognizes them and they can't be recognized? And this is an interesting solution. 10 days on, 20 days off. 10 days on, 20 days off. 10 days on, 20 days off. It's like shift work for killing. I thought that was an interesting exploration there. Another thing which works really well that I actually quite like in this novel is that the soldier boys aren't just linked up to one person, or they are. So each soldier who is operating a soldier boy robot isn't just linked up with the robot. They're actually linked up with each other. It's called jacking in. So there's a plug in the back of the brain. It's a bit like post-Matrix kind of thing, this book. So there's a thing, they're sticking a plug in the back of the brain, or a jack in the back of the brain, and then you are jacked in with the robot, but they're also jacked in to each other. So they're all kind of like this weird hive mind. They all know what each other are thinking, and also they know what each other have thought. They know each other's emotions and memories and everything like that. So once the 10 people, 5 males, 5 females, get together, jack in together and start a mission, everything that they've been through in that last 20 days back in the real world, they then all experience that from each other. Now, I was never quite sure why this decision to do this was made. I was thinking, is it just for plot reasons or is there a technical reason? I can't remember if it's like, oh yeah, and because they're all a unit, they're all, it's a really slick fighting force and everybody works together really well. Because if that's the case, it doesn't work. Like they kept turning up, and Julian, who is the main character of the book, he's always like, at one point he's the leader of the squad and he's like, no, don't do that, no, I'm making the decision, stop fighting like this, and there's all like everything is wrong at one point, and some people seize up and other people go crazy, and it's like, no, what are you doing over there, what are you doing? And I'm thinking, well, if this is all one mind, if this is all like one kind of hive mind, different people linking up together for better views and better communication, it just doesn't work very well. They're not very good soldiers, and the whole linking the brains together, while I thought that was very interesting for many other reasons, in a military tactical advantage, I couldn't really see it very much. So what else do we have here? I don't think I only made like five notes. So yeah, these are driven by conscripted men enlistments. So yeah, what happens is that Julian is our main protagonist for the first. He's our protagonist for the first half of the book. There's not really a strong story. It's more of like the Forever War. He goes on an adventure, comes back, has to deal with it. Goes on another adventure, comes back, has to deal with it. And it's strange because you always like there's always this edge of danger because you'd think, oh, the people back home who were driving these soldier boys, they're all safe, aren't they? Turns out, no, they're not, because they have like seizures and strokes and they get suicidal. And if something happens, they can be, you know, that they can go crazy, but then they can't pretend to be crazy. It's the whole catch-22 situation. They don't want people to go crazy. But then because you can jack into them, the psychologist can jack into them and go, ah, how are these people working? And Julian works at a university. He's a physicist or physics teacher or postdoc at a physics university. Some of the people that he works with are actually the people who kind of invented or worked on the early jacking technology. And they're going, oh yeah, we're testing this. And like what the group dynamic has to be. They always have to have like some people who are a little bit crazy, who don't mind killing the enemy, which is good. But then you always need someone in there as a who's going to be the conscience of the group, who can keep the group in control. And if some people feel suicidal, how is that going to spread to other people? You know, so it seems to be quite a dangerous setup that they have, but very, very effective because the soldiers never die in the field. So that's an interesting situation. So yeah, whenever Julian comes home, he has to deal with the situation. And also, people follow along. There's the people called the War Boys, who are the like war fans of the mechanical warfare. And even though Julian's group isn't a killing group, they're more of like a scouting group and a searching group, and we're gonna, you know, pick up this, you know, like the non-deadly mission objectives are the ones that they fulfill, his squad fulfills. So the War Boys, who are the war fans and who follow along with the exploits of the soldiers, don't really follow his group so much, but of course as he gets into more adventures, he gets more followers and people like ask him questions when they find out he's a soldier, and like, oh, you in this group? Yeah, I'm in that group. So that was another aspect that I thought was quite interesting there. The concept of people following along with war as though it is entertainment. Very interesting stuff. So yeah, the first half of the book I thought was really, really good. I'll take a drink. It weirdly goes in and out of first person and third person narrative, but the third person narrative is quite tight. And I was thinking, oh, this is either bad writing or it's clever writing, because sometimes there doesn't seem to be any transitions like or chapter headings or anything like that. I was listening to it as an audiobook. There didn't seem to be that many transitions. It would just be like, I did this and then I did that. And then it would kind of fade out and it'd be like, is it still in first person? And then it goes, and Julian did this and Julian thought that. And I was like, oh, okay, no, it isn't. It's back to third person again. And I was like, is this what it's like? Is this the experience? Is this just a literary exploration of what it's like to be jacking into other people's minds and other people jacking into your minds? That sometimes you're thinking, oh, I do this, I do that, I do this. And then sometimes you're being like, other people are watching you, like the war boys at home are watching you and they're going, and then he does this and then he does that. And then other times you're not quite sure because it's not the war boys at home watching you. It's the colleagues, like the people who you're jacked in with. There's always like 11, 12 of the people who you can in contact with at all times during your mission. And I'm thinking, well, are those the people who are looking at him from not the first person point of view, but kind of like a close third person point of view? So again, while I thought it was a little bit confusing in sometimes, I thought that was quite a fun way of like disconnecting us from the like. It's like us jacking into and jacking out of Julian, our first character, our first person narrator, when it goes into first person. So yeah, Julian he goes on these missions and he comes home and he's kind of got a girlfriend who is a few years older than him. Oh, and Julian is black, but she's white, from Boston, I think, or he's from Boston. I can't remember. No, he was a black man whose family was up in Boston, and they have to face the racism of being a black man with an older white girlfriend. And I thought that was sometimes a bit heavy-handed, certainly in the second half, a little bit too heavy-handed, because I was thinking, well, maybe in 2047, when's this book set? Let me look it up. 2043, hopefully that kind of racism would be gone. But then it's explained that actually the whole war has turned racism back around again, because if people say it's not just about the haves and have-nots, it's because the haves are white people and the have-nots are the brown-coloured people who live south of the United States. So there's a bit of like, hey, I'm a black man fighting for America. America, yeah. But at the same time, or the Alliance, I think it's called, like the coalition of the willing or whatever it is. So yeah, it's like, yes, I fight for them, but then people think I'm on the other side just because I'm a black man. And I thought that was a little bit heavy-handed. But, you know, that's part of this relationship. One of the main things that are standing in the way of the relationship progressing is that he has got a jack in the back of his head and the girlfriend hasn't got a jack in the back of his head. And he has this past with someone else who also had a jack, and jacking in with someone and then having sex seems to be a pretty interesting experience, by all accounts, a very heightened experience. And while I thought that was like an interesting dynamic to their relationship, in a way, I thought it was quite refreshing that it wasn't just all about, oh, I have a jack and you don't, we have a jacks together and we're going to jack in and have sex. Like, I thought it was more interesting when that was kind of more in the background of their relationship and their relationship was a bit more grown up. But as the book goes on and goes into the second half, especially, it seems to be much more about, oh, our relationship is only going to be worth something if we can jack in together and have amazing sex. Even though it's much more than just having an amazing sex, everything in the second half of the book seemed to be brought down to, hey, amazing sex level. Whereas in the first half, it's a lot more subtle. It's a lot more satisfying. So yes, he has to deal with that and about his older girlfriend, Blaze, I think her name is, going on about what she goes through and what she thinks that she needs to do to stay together with a younger boyfriend who has a jack in his head, and what she thinks she needs to do that. All very interesting. Up until the point where it talks about, oh, like, what's it like to do this? You know, you're involved in this, massive post-traumatic stress, what's happening here? And there was an interesting scene with one of the characters. I don't want to give away too much because I think you should really read up into this point. It's an interesting scene with a psychologist, and then about a chapter later, even though I'm not sure there was chapter markers, I can't remember. But a bit later, there is a suicide attempt. And what I do think you should do is just stop reading at the suicide attempt. It's a complete story. It's not a strong plot, but it's an interesting exploration of a character, of a situation, of technology, of a society, of a war, of some relationships. It's not, nothing is really deep, but it's a lot to think about, because you're like, this guy wrote this book in 1997. This is clever stuff, considering what we have today with the war on terror, drone warfare, like, you know, political instability, social inequality, some racism stuff, relationship, you know, all of that is good. At the suicide attempt, stop reading. Really, stop reading. Just stop, and you'll think this is a book. The first half of this book for me is a decent easily 4-star book. And I was thinking, this is exactly what I want. This is so much stuff which is right in, I was talking about this on the last podcast, right in my wheelhouse. It kind of like I wrote a book called Combat and my Minding Tomorrow series. It's like so much of what I wrote in there is sort of like, this is an exploration of the similar questions, even to the same things that Julian goes through as a pacifist in a war zone. He's like, well, what if I try and shoot the weapon out the guy's hand, or what if I just try and shoot the guy in the leg? And of course, those are the kind of questions that I talk about in my novel Combat. And the character kind of goes through a similar journey in this, not to the same place, but is wrangling with the same questions. I'm like, this is really good. This is exactly the kind of thing that I like. It's a military science fiction story told from the point of someone who doesn't like war, and told from the point, like, as an author who doesn't like war, obviously, but also exploring the character of someone who's like inside is a pacifist and just can't really do it, can't really cope with being in a war, is good at what he does in some ways, but also bad at what he's doing in some ways, and how he deals with it. Stop reading at that point. Halfway through, just stop reading. So, 4 stars for the first half. What am I going to talk about in the second half? It turns really stupid really, really quickly. I might go into spoiler territories, but not spoiler territories from the first half, only spoiler territories for the second half. Excuse me, it's a quick drink here. It's very hot today in Germany, like 32 degrees, which is very hot here. So what happens is sometime at the beginning of the book, it say, hey, there's this Jupiter project. And you're like, ah, Jupiter project. It's some like Large Hadron Collider thing. And everyone talks about Large Hadron Collider. You know, this is a bit, it's quite big. This is a Large Hadron Collider, a particle accelerator, which is as wide as, I think it's Europa or some other moon of, I think it's a moon of Jupiter. Of course, it's the Jupiter project. I can't remember which moon of Jupiter. And it uses power from the inside of Jupiter, inside the storms of Jupiter, beams that up to orbit to the something. It's this accelerator being built in orbit, but it's not just being built in orbit. It orbits the entire moon of Europa or Triton or Io or whatever, whichever the moon is. So that's there, and that's mentioned in the first half of the book. And you're like, oh, that's interesting, because the guy's a physicist, his girlfriend's a particle physicist, and that's what they talk about, physics, and she's working on that project, and it's a big part of her life. Great. And then there's another thing that's kind of mentioned, people called the Enders. And the Enders are this religious cult who think the world should end. And you're like, okay, great. And then, in the second half of the book, those things which were just kind of slight flavour to the book suddenly become what the book is about. In other words, the Large Hadron Collider, you're like, what do people say about the Large Hadron Collider? Oh, if we turn it on, the universe might end because we're recreating the conditions at the start of the Big Bang. That's what this book is about. Suddenly, it's no longer about a guy's personal struggles in Central America fighting against people and abducting people and trying not to kill people but accidentally killing people, all that kind of good stuff in the first book. All of that literally just disappears. None of that happens in the second half of the book. That was the stuff that I most liked about it. It just disappeared. And suddenly the bad guys are a group of people who want to end the world and have discovered all they need to do to end the world is make sure the Jupiter project goes ahead and the world will be destroyed. Not just the world, like the universe will be destroyed. Spoilers. But it's not even a spoiler because you're just like, wait, that's what the book's going to be about now? And suddenly the book is about, we've got to stop the Jupiter project happening, but it isn't hard to stop it happening, except these people want it to go ahead, and suddenly there's this massive conspiracy theory. Oh, there's people in this part of the government, and there's people in this part of this academia, and there's people over here in this part of the government, and there's people here in the military, and this is happening, and that is happening, and this is happening, and that's happening as well. And you're just like, oh, so it's just a big conspiracy theory now of these religious fanatics, which religious fanatics is a little bit too easy for science fiction. It's like, oh, we need some bad guys with like wishy-washy motivations to have a threat. And you're like, well, religious fanatics, got it, let's do it. Which is stupid, really, really stupid, because there's no reason given except, oh, they're psychopaths who think God's talking to them. Great, right. Okay, so that's what we've got to go about. But then you'd think that's stupid, but it gets way, 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 way stupider than that. You think, well, the Forever Peace. I thought, like, in the first half of the book, I thought, well, the Forever Peace, that's an ironic title, isn't it? Because there's never going to be peace. The Forever Peace is actually continuous war. Like, when war is indistinguishable from peace, if the war goes on long enough, like the War on Terror, like, we're at peace, kind of, but we're at war, kind of. I thought it was an ironic title about what the first half of the book was all about, that, like, Forever Peace is like, yeah, peace 20 days a month, but then 10 days a month, yeah, but peace forever for everyone, except for the 10 days a month where unfortunately we're at war. I thought the title was like that, but instead it's just like, oh man, there's always going to be people who want to end the world. Let's make it so that nobody can ever end the world and nobody's ever bad again. So it just so happens that one of the characters has already invented this technology, using this jacking in with people, to change people's personalities so they're incapable of hurting anybody anymore. And they're like, okay, let's do that. And so then the rest of the book is two things which are totally disconnected, but they seem to be kind of like crammed together in this really, really shit, heavy-handed way where it's like, oh, we need to take over the entire government of the United States, take over the entire world, literally reprogram everybody's brain on the planet to stop them wanting to fight in any wars or be bad or harm humanity or the rest of humanity in any way. And so that's one plot that's going on. But at the same time, the Enders, the Hand of God cult, is trying to end the world and trying to stop them doing stuff. And it's like, but this is disconnected. Why did you just go, okay, what we should do Let's root out the people, the Hand of God cult. Let's stop them. Let's stop the Jupiter Project. Now, once we've gone all of that, okay, we've stopped all of that. Now, let's see what we can do about forever piecing up the planet, like turning everyone into hippies who are incapable of harming people. It's two different stories. It's two different goals. And because nobody knows, like I was saying, that the whole Hand of God cult, the Ender cult, is like a conspiracy. But to fight that conspiracy, they set up another conspiracy. And one guy goes, oh, I know this general in Washington. He'll help us out. And he just calls up. And it's like this Deus Ex Machina general who just always just goes, oh, we need something happening. We need to fly here. Okay, I'll just call the general. Yep, here we go. He booked our flights for us. Oh, we need to get this vehicle to move somewhere. I'll just call the general. Oh, yep, I just called him. The guy in Washington says yes. Oh, we need to do this. We need to change national policy on prisoners of war. Oh, I'll just call the guy up in Washington. Yep, he says it's okay. Let's do this. And it's just like time and time again. It's like, is it that easy? Is it just that easy to have someone who used to be like your friend and you just keep calling them up and he just like unquestioningly does anything that you want to do? So it's like the two stories don't go together. Both of them are two of the stupidest things that I've ever read in science fiction. Just awful, just terrible stuff. And yeah, and what else was I going to say about this? So, yeah, also, I was talking about the ending, like what I don't like about science fiction. What I hate about science fiction is kind of wrapped up in, I talked about this in my review of, what was it, the Neal Stephenson book, what is it, Snow Crash. So in Snow Crash, someone says, hey, what about this? Like the librarian talks to him and says, hey, what about this? And he just goes, oh, I will just come up with a theory, apply it to the world, and then act in this world as though that theory isn't just something that's in my head, but it is actually true. And then the rest of the story just continues on without me having to prove it one way or the other. But because I'm the main character and I think it should be true, suddenly it just applies to everything and everything and it's unquestionably real. And that is what that's like the worst stuff that just doesn't, for me, doesn't work. It's like, where's the trial and error? Like, that's not how science works. You can't just come up with a theory and just go, ah, how about this? Well, I think that's good. Now let's all of us get together and put loads of people's lives at risk and do everything we possibly can to get this stuff in motion and do it all. And how much evidence you have that it's got to work? Well, I know it was just this theory that I had. Now, in this book, there is a little bit of evidence this thing has worked, but some guy goes, oh, I've got this plan to turn everyone into hippies, to make everybody so they can't harm another human being. And you're like, great. How much proof did anybody want? It's like, I'll go and check on your work. One guy goes and checks on these other people, and literally with no proof at all that what they're doing is ethical. Well, it's certainly totally unethical. Like, it's out of the realms of unethical into evil. And so many people are at risk doing this operation to make people into pacifist zombies in a way, but they just go with it, and it's like, it takes a step for the worse. It's not just like, ha, I've come up with this idea, and now if everyone just acts on this idea, it will work because that's what the author wants the protagonist to think. And it's not even the protagonist who comes up with this idea; it's just another guy. You know, it's not even our main character, Julian. It's just free ranging at that point. It's like, oh, someone over here is doing something, and then someone over here is doing something, and then someone's over. It's like, well, what's our main character doing? He's not doing anything. He's just like this guy who is now just a pawn in two other people's plans for the world. Really strange. But then it turns out that it's actually easier than everything it worked that anyone thought. Like, science doesn't work that way. You can't just go like, step A, declare that something is so. Step B, act on it and everything goes exactly according to plan, because why wouldn't it? Because, you know, the author isn't good enough at writing any kind of like trial and error or proof or anything like that. And then here, C, turns out it's actually way easier than they thought it was. They're like, oh, we thought it was going to take 2 weeks. Turns out it only takes 2 days. And you're like, oh, so we'll get finished earlier then. Yeah, we'll get finished early. Isn't that convenient? Yeah, really convenient. How convenient is it? Well, it sounds like the guy who's writing the book didn't have enough to finish the plot and didn't want to keep going on in this way. So if we just make it all easier, we can end the book faster, because now it's easier for everyone to do everything that they wanted to do. So then you're like, well, what are they fighting against? They're not fighting against anything. They're not fighting against the world. They're fighting, it's like this one conspiracy again of hidden agents in government and hidden agents in the military and hidden agents in in academia and stuff against another conspiracy. So it's two conspiracies fighting each other in secret, playing with the lives, literally playing with what the fate of the entire galaxy or universe or solar system, and at the same time playing with the fate of humanity. And yeah, I'm just like, well, great. Like, that's interesting that you decided to take all of that into your own hands. Wouldn't it have been way better to, instead of you, like, stopping what some people play in gods by you playing God yourself in these conspiracies? Anyway, I'm just thinking, it's like the worst example of storytelling I've ever heard. Because in the end, it's like, oh, we need to do this thing. What's stopping us? This psychopath who is coming in, who is trying to kill this one person. That's our main obstacle? Yeah, that's our main obstacle. And you think, well, how would you deal with it? Maybe when they come in, you check if they have any weapons. And they come in, it's like, do they have any weapons? No. The scan says no weapons. And you're like, you can make weapons out of anything. Literally, people have technology to be able to build anything out of any designs at all, anything at all that they want out of any materials. Put the materials in and you can build anything. So why wouldn't you build a plastic gun or a glass gun or something that can kill people which can't be picked up by metal detectors? And I'm thinking, in 2043, are people just going to rely on metal detectors? Like, this is just the worst security ever. Someone comes in and just, like, frisk them down, like, just pat them down. It's like, everybody knows what airport security is like. You know, you don't just walk through the metal detector. Well, you do, actually. But you have to kind of empty your pockets, and they pat down your pockets. If anything goes off, you're like, just pat down the pockets. You know this person is really, really dangerous. You know they're a psychopath. You know they're from the other side. You know who they're trying to kill. Don't just put them in a room with these other people. And it's like, well, like, you'd think that if it's impossible for me to kill people, like, if my brain has been fucked up in such a way that it's now impossible for me to harm anyone, you'd think that you'd do your best to, like, put yourself in situations where someone can't harm you. In other words, if someone, you think someone might have a gun or a weapon, just pat them down. Just pat them down. Like, how hard can it be? But that's the level. It's like, and I've mentioned this in reviews before, it's like, all that it takes for stupid people to succeed is other people to be more stupid. All it takes for evil people to succeed is for to be defeated is for them to be marginally more stupid than the stupid good people. It's like, where's the intelligence of any of this kind of stuff? It's just awful. And then suddenly the next thing is like, well, one person gets killed off, and you're like, oh, great. So that's one of the bad psychopath guys who is just going to come in and cause havoc and disrupt their plans by being nasty and killing people. You think, well, that's good. What's their next thing that they've got to fight against in the next 3 hours of this audiobook? Just someone else who just comes in who's also a psychopath, and then you're like, oh, great, so now we've got to do all of that again, of someone bad coming in. You think, didn't you just go through all of this? You just handcuffed a guy and then unhandcuffed him, and then he killed people, and now you're letting someone else in who isn't handcuffed? Like, why? Just shoot them. It's like, oh, you can't shoot them because you've had your brain altered, so you can't shoot them, except there's one guy over here whose brain isn't altered. Anyway, it's just awful. Next thing, that's really bad about it. I mentioned in the first half of this review is that it goes in and out of third person. Suddenly, like, Julian, who is the main character all the way through, it's either close third person or first person in his head. Suddenly it's like, oh, we've got some story going on over here and Julian's not over there. Well, we'll just take the third person over here. It's now third person omniscience. And then suddenly it's like the first person is talking in the past tense rather than the present tense. I mean, it was always in, like, the past tense. It's like, I did this, I did that, I did this. But now it's sort of like, oh, and I would live to regret that. And you're like, and then suddenly the omniscient narrator would be like, and then this happened, but they didn't know how bad it would be. And I'm like, where's this narrator now? Like, who is this person? I thought this third person narrator was the people who were jacking into his head, or the people who were jacking into these other people's heads. Like, what's going on? Just suddenly the writing is just awful and just rubbish. What else have we got here? Yeah. So the language is it's kind of Orwellian. I'm not quite sure, like, who are the good guys by the end. It's really quite depressing that, like, you've got, like, it's like, yes, forever peace. What is the forever peace? We're going to do a mind-altering operation on everyone in the entire world. Everyone's going to have a jackpot in their head, and they're going to have this, you know, do this experience to make it so they can't harm other people. And you should, I would call that operation, like, making people docile or making people, you know, pacifist or whatever it's going to be, you know. And they say, oh, no, we're making them humanized. And I'm like, no, you're dehumanizing. You're taking away their free will. And that's the thing that it always comes back to when in the discussions about free will and humanity is that, like, free will only means anything if it's possible for us to use our free will to do stupid stuff and to do harmful stuff. That's what it's like free speech. Like, free speech isn't only for people who say sensible stuff. Free speech is really tested when the stupid people say something. And they're saying, like, in the book, ah, oh, we humanize people. They went through the humanized operations. And you're like, really? That's the word you're using. Like, you're taking away their humanity, part of what it means for humans to be humans. In other words, that we get angry and violent. It's not a good part of humanity, but it is part of all humanity. Like, children have to be taught not to hit each other. You know, they don't, children don't get taught how to be violent. I mean, maybe they are taught by television or computer games or whatever you want to say, but, like, you know, it's part of our human condition to be violent sometimes. When not everyone's a born pacifist. Some people are. Some people learn it. Some people don't learn it. It's just part of the human experience. But if that's forced on you, it's not a human experience anymore. So I thought that whole language there was really bad. And then I was thinking, well, how does it work? It's like, oh, it turns out that the people who have gone through the humanizing operation, they can still defend themselves. They don't mind using violence or they don't mind using force to defend themselves, but they can't do any action to harm other people. And as you're reading through this, it's like, this is the wishy-washiest, most magical thinking ever, that someone can just have an operation and be linked up in such a way that suddenly they don't want to harm other people anymore. Harming humanity or harming other people is such a difficult concept that Isaac Asimov wrote series and series of books, like a whole series of books about the robots. Like, the three laws of robotics are that same kind of thing. What does it mean to cause harm to humans? And how can anybody, how can any agent, how can any robot, how can any human ever know what the consequences of their actions going to be? It's always like, yes. So if one person sets, you say, hey, you robot, make this thing that is actually poisonous and put it here in this bowl. And then they go off. And then you say, hey, you other robot, take this stuff in this bowl and pour it into this glass and take it through and put it down there. Hey, and you other robot, pick it up and then feed it to this person over there. And you can get three robots who individually are programmed not to be able to harm another human and make them harm another human. You know, that's the classic example. And of course, Asimov just waved this away by going, oh yes, it's integral to the positronic brain. And I can't remember who said this, but maybe it was Eric Rabkin, who's a professor of science fiction and stuff. And he says, yeah, you know, the three, when you read the Asimov robot stories, what you're actually doing is like reading a fairy tale. It's like when someone says at the start of a fairy tale, once upon a time, there was this who lived in a wood here. You think, okay, in this story is going to be magic, and I'm just going to allow magic and fairies and wolves that talk and animals that talk. That's just it. And when you say, when at the start of a book, it's like, this is a robot book. Here are the three laws of robotics. If it opens up in the introduction or with the prologue or something, three laws of robotics, you're like, great, I know where I'm in. I'm in a world where this is the one gimme. This is the one thing that the author doesn't have to explain. We'll just go with it. We'll just pretend that this is part of the positronic brain. Now, in this book, it suddenly comes up halfway through the book. After the halfway point, someone goes, ha, got this thing where nobody will be able to cause harm to anybody else. And you're like, you can't just jump there. That's too much of a gimme at that point. That's too much of a leap to take in science fiction that you can suddenly say, all of humanity, there is one thing that if you change something in the brain, they won't be allowed to harm other people. It's more complicated than that. Harming other people is more complicated than just being like what they consciously think about. And if it is something conscious in their brain that they're deciding not to kill other, to hurt other people or kill other people or harm other people in some way, if it's conscious, you changing that changes them as a human. They're not them anymore. You're creating in some way a zombie. You're taking over their brains. You're changing them, like, within their brains, which is the most unethical people. You are causing them harm. Like, that's what's literally happening. And they're saying, we will do this so we can't harm anybody. And it's like, well, how many people die of this operation? About 2% of the population might die if we do this operation on everyone to stop at the people causing harm. And then, like, how did you get these people who've already had this operation to help you in this, knowing that they will be killing 2% or harming 2% of the population in a way that can't be, you can't go back on that. And like all of these questions going on in my head, it's like, how can you just say we can't harm anyone except in self-defense? Like, what is, like, it's just not explained at all. There's nothing there. And the worst thing, you may think this is bad already, but the worst thing about this is the whole reason they're going through this is because they want to come up with a way to stop people wiping out the entire world or galaxy, not because they're bad people, not because they want to harm people, but just because there's this large Hadron Collider, which is actually going to end the universe, and they're going to set it off without knowing that it's going to end the universe accidentally. That's what they think is going to happen. They think this is going to happen accidentally. So to stop something happen accidentally, they're going to then change the entire world to say, let's not do it consciously. And I'm thinking, well, what good is it to change everybody so they can't harm people consciously if they can still wipe out the galaxy the universe accidentally? So, like, that's what I said, it comes down to the fundamental fact that there's two stories going on in the second half of the book. One, closing down the Jupiter Project. Two, brainwashing everyone in the world not to cause harm to anyone at all. Totally disconnected, even in their goals and aims and methods and everything. It's just utter garbage. And at the end of the book, there's some people, it's like, well, the operation doesn't work for these people. What are you going to do with them? And it's like, well, what we'll do, we'll just round them up and put them in concentration camps and separate them off for the rest of humanity. And you're like, is that really, like, is that cool? Like, the people who are less fortunate, like, it's just massive and blatant racism, which is what it'll come down to in the end. Is that really what it's like? And I'm thinking, this guy and his girlfriend, they go at the end, they're like, oh, we'll go over to the concentration camps over there. Oh, it's fine by me. I guess we're an endangered species now because there's only 2% of us in the whole world, and we're going to go and live on this island over here. It's like Cuba and Dominican Republic or whatever, you know, that island's down there. Oh, and also British Columbia as well. So people live there, and there's some people in Taiwan who are all the Chinese, and it doesn't work for them. It's just like, what's going on here? Like, so everybody who can cause harm to other humans are just rounded up and put into the camps. And that's the happy end of the book. So I'm just not sure, like, what is this book about? It's so shit at the end that I can't believe, like, the writing is so bad. All of the characters are just random. And there's characters like, oh, Rey is over here. And I said, didn't Rey die? And I'm thinking, oh, maybe it was that other character who I couldn't remember anything about. Because, like, I thought all these characters in the first half of the book were just friends of Julian's girlfriend. You know, like, oh, they're minor characters. They're people he talks to. Some doctors he talks to over here. Some other physicists over here. I thought they were just minor characters. In the end, those are the ones driving the plot. Everything that's happening in the end of the book has got nothing to do with Julian. He's just this piece that's being moved around, and other people are just people who are being moved around, and like nobody seems to be in charge. There's nobody, one person going, great, we'll do it this way, or if there is, it's someone, but then he dies and then someone else take it. It's like, why is everyone doing this? It's like, oh, we're having a bloodless coup, like we're gonna take over everything we're doing, we're just gonna take over secretly with this big conspiracy. It's just utter shit that leads to more shit. And I was getting to the end of this, like, how can this be so bad? Like, how could the first half of the book be so good? Like, if the book had stopped halfway through, or there'd been, like, you know, or wherever it stopped. If it stopped, I'd been like, that's a 4-star book. There's so much good stuff in there. Everything that I enjoyed about the first half of the book was taken away from me and was replaced by the worst shit conspiracy theory jerking, and there's sex here and this here and that person, and it's just like, oh, just, and there's this character, oh, and there's an old woman character, oh, and she's really good, oh, but she's died now, isn't that really sad? And I'm like, no, I don't give a shit, I cared about Julian and the people that Julian and the things that Julian was doing at the start of the book. Like, why make me care about this character and then just make him into a background character who's being manipulated and lied to and then is happy about it because, oh, now the world's at peace and everyone's happy. It's like, everyone's been brainwashed. This isn't going to stick. This is just it's an awful dystopian view. And it's like, just like, if this is the best that any kind of pacifistic literature can be, like, this is someone's vision of a peaceful future, of forever peace. The guy who wrote Forever War, which is kind of like a reaction against something like, Starship Troopers or whatever, you know, however you want to read those books in conversation with each other, it's like, is this meant to be part of the same conversation? Because if so, it is utter drivel in the second half. First half, good. So I'm going to wrap this up. I'm going to give this book 1.5 stars in total, which pains me to say it, but like, I can't forgive anything in the second half, and it spoiled so much of the first half to me. And it wasn't even as if I was like, oh, I'll just go and look up the Wikipedia page and see what the plot thing is. You know, the plot spoilers, so it isn't there. It goes, and it just says here, it goes, by humanizing the entire world, dangerous technology would not be a problem for human surviving, except if someone does it by accident. It says, they make a plan to stop it. They do so. And war is eventually stopped. I'm like, that's it? Like, the whole second half of the book is wrapped up in, like, the one sentence. They do so, stop the particle accelerator's construction, and the war is eventually stopped. And I was like, well, that's great. How can I use the plot summary where everything in it, there's 7 paragraphs about the first half of the book. And then, you know, including up to that, like, middle turning section of the book where we understand actually what the main story of the book's going to be, or the same main story of the second half is going to be. But the whole thing is just, like, hour after hour. I was just like, how far can I skip forward? So I was skipping forward 5 minutes, and it was still just the same shit of people talking about, oh, if we go here and move there, and we got to move these people here, and we got to put these in the jack, and we got to jack these people. And I was like, ah, fuck, I'm just still listening to that. So I skipped forward, like, another 20, 30 minutes, and it's like, and then this person came in, and that person had a gun, and they tried shooting, and I was like, fuck, still skipping forward, and then I listened to the last hour, and it was just terrible. So I can't recommend this book at all, except for the first half. The writing, I talked a bit about the writing. The reading was actually really good. It's quite funny listening to two audiobooks. It was read by George Wilson, who also narrated the last book that I reviewed, which was, I will just look it up, I've forgotten what it is. I did the sorting wrong. So the last one was, David Brin's Star Tide Rising. This is another book in a recorded book series, which I guess Audible got in because these are the prestigious books, you know, Hugo Nebula Award books. It's obviously all in the same series, yeah. And read by George Wilson. Actually did a really good job in this one. I complained by some of his choices in the first book. Here, everything seems to be fine. He's a really good reader. But 12 hours and 40 minutes when, like, 6 hours and 40 minutes of those are not worth listening to at all. I'm not sure if I can recommend this. But if you want to listen to this book for free, you can. And I'll do my plug here for Audible. Go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP. audibletrial.com/SFBRP. And start your free trial today. You can get this book or any other book for free. Download it. 20,000 books that you can choose from. Download it, give it a listen, and if you want to continue your subscription, you pay a little bit of money each month. I have the Platinum Award, so I get 2 credits a month, which means I can listen to 2 audiobooks, download and listen to 2 audiobooks per month. I've got 2 credits available at the moment, and I'm moving on to the next audiobook, the next Hugo and Nebula Award audiobook, a winning novel as an audiobook, which I'll get into next, which is actually The Paladin of Souls by Luc Mestre-Bujold, which hopefully this is going to be a lot better than the first one, The Curse of Treilion, which was the first book in that series. I've listened to over an hour already, and it's already describing, and then they had this for dinner, and then they had this for dinner, and then they had this conversation about going on a trip, and then they had this, so I'm not sure if I can, how much I'm going to get through this book, but I'm going to give it a go anyway, because it's a Hugo Nebula Award, and the voters of both the Hugo and Nebula Award can't have better taste in books than I do, can they? Can they? Can they? Anyway, so yeah, check out audibletrial.com/SFBRP to help out the me and the SFBRP and my book reading habits and everything like that. So one other thing that I wanted to do is have a look actually on Goodreads and see what other people think about this book. 3.7 out of 5 stars is what people on Goodreads give it. There seems to be a lot of people who have the same opinion as me. So one person says the first half was... Oh no, that's my review. Anyway, so there's quite a few reviews here. I was going to read one, but I scrolled back up to the top of the page and stuff like that. Anyway, lots of people say, first half... So this was the review I was looking for. Scott rated it 2 stars. This book is either the best bad book or the worst good book in science fiction, depending on your perspective. It basically reads like 2 separate novellas forced together into a single storyline. The first storyline revolves around technological as well as psychological needs. for future, near future worldwide guerrilla war. Yeah, blah, blah. So exactly the same thing. Lots of people are giving this 2 stars as well. I'm giving it 1.5 stars only because in my scheme of rating, I can go to point stars, whereas on Goodreads, most people either have to give it 1 or 2 stars. And lots of people give this book 2 stars and have similar opinions as I do. Guillermo, another SFBRP listener. Fred Hughes, 4 stars. Oh, yeah, Guillermo, 2 stars. Michael, 2 stars. But then lots of 5 stars. It's like, I can't understand how people can forgive the second half of this book, but somehow people do. So, yeah, you can follow me on goodreads.com so I can also see what you think of the books that I've read, if you've also read them, and I can follow along with your reading, you can follow along with mine. You can also join in with the SFBRP listener group. It's I offload any kind of community and social media stuff to Goodreads, so for the SFBRP, so you can chat with other SFBRP listeners there. You can email me, luke@juggler.net. I do reply to every email that I get and reply to every question that I get sent as well. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on Twitter. That's it from me this time out. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.